Hey, podcast listeners, you're listening to a recording made on the 20th of July, 2015, and that's different from the date you're about to hear, which is because it's for the broadcast listeners. Anyway, to you, I want to say thank you for downloading. This is Geek Speak for Saturday, July 25th, 2015. We're broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Primsch, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam, a political junkie and goat herder. Congratulations on the goat herding gig, Miles.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Lyle Troxel, programmer, photographer, gardener, gamer, and welder.
Hey.
Hey. So lots to talk about today, and in general, we like to cover Elon Musk somewhere in there.
We always have to because he's amazing, and his ventures are, of course, incredible as well.
He's totes amazing. What I'm not sure about is if Miles is prepared at this time.
Well, basically, you know about SpaceX, right? His engagement in space exploration. It's not just him, of course. It's a giant company,
yeah.
And they're flying things into space all the time, most of the time successfully.
Yeah. However,
last week we covered the fault, actually, an exploded rocket. Nobody was on it.
Right.
But it was one of the first real serious failures of theirs. And, of course, we expected some kind of understanding of what actually occurred with the Falcon failure. The Falcon rocket was that failed.
Right.
And SpaceX says that it was a structural member.
Oh.
And basically, they've discovered what it was, and of course, they will fix that in the future.
It's a strut that failed, and then it compressed a pressure line, the helium,
and helium stopped flowing?
Yes.
Yeah.
The helium must flow.
So that's not good. We have to have flowing helium.
What is a strut? I've always thought of struts in cars. You know, you replace them and stuff, but I actually don't know what a strut is. I'm assuming it's some kind of thing that holds stuff up.
Of it as being sort of piston-y. Is a strut piston-y? It has goo in it.
In this case,
strut, a rod or bar forming a part of a framework and designed to resist compression. Ah, it shouldn't have compressed.
Oh.
Hence the compression problem.
It was supposed to resist that.
It was supposed to withstand up to 10,000 pounds, and it compressed under 2,000. And they went back and they found a design flaw. Manufacturing flaw, right?
Manufacturing, okay. That's more expected. A manufacturing flaw sounds more like something would happen rather than a design flaw because you'd have a lot of people involved in the design
right.
of it.
Okay,
and just one little tiny bubble of whatever it was.
Okay.
I'm going to guess aluminum, but I have no idea.
Who knows?
Well, thanks, Miles.
Some sort of an alloy, perhaps. All right, so that's what's happening at SpaceX. And you're quite right, Lyles. We shouldn't just say Elon Musk is how could he do all this stuff?
No. Even if he's sexy and great.
Yeah. And because now let's move on
smart.
To Tesla. Tesla.
He's also Elon Musk. Yeah.
Yes, there is a new version of the Model S coming out.
Yeah.
That is there's the 60 kilowatt hour, there's the 85 kilowatt hour in the performance version. There's a 90 coming out now.
Okay.
Battery technology is improving, so they're able to get the costs and the capacities up.
So it's about having a longer life on the battery?
Yes.
Okay.
Or in this case, it can make it go faster. They have
they're going for faster.
The output from the output from the battery, they've increased it so that now they can get 0 to 60 in 2.8 seconds, which is about a half
enough.
A second faster than the previous.
Wait a
really,
minute.
Really
and
fast.
About a minute faster than you need.
wait. The previous really, really fast. What?
Wow,
car that Tesla has made?
Yeah, like 3 seconds.
Did they just upgrade their car by half a second, basically?
Well, the battery improved, but there's also software improvements.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
It's not just about going super fast.
I mean,
no, it's just about going super fast.
It's not it's not the fastest vehicle, but it is really fast at this point. And amazing and all that, but...
So it's
going to be
about
that, one of the fastest street legal cars out there.
Is the ludicrous speed quote yours, or is it the article that you quoted?
Oh, no, I think it's part of the UI. Like, you have to set it to, there's a ludicrous speed setting.
Yeah. Does they have a plaid setting as well?
Oh, that's so.
Yeah.
But
speak to that.
I'm confused because I thought Tesla was going for an electric car, which could seriously go for a while. But it sounds like they're just going for the sporty spice.
Yeah, distance is definitely a major factor in electric vehicles. They've got to prove themselves. And the problem with my Leaf, for example, is I can go about 100 miles and then I got to charge for a long time.
Yeah.
Tesla's doing all things, and all these car companies are doing all things. But they do have to make something that you can go far enough. The Tesla actually has a pretty good battery pack. I think it's got a 300-mile range. Not if you're traveling that fast, of course, because speed kills performance for
longevity. If what they're trying to do is build a long-running vehicle.
I don't think they're trying to
give you the temptation to go faster than you can possibly.
It's the same thing as with a gas-powered car. If you go 40 miles per hour, you're going to go a lot further than if you're going 80 miles per hour.
Right. Yeah.
But people like to drive 80.
Yeah, and if you're in the ultimate speed machine,
I wouldn't say
you're not
going to
like putter along at a reasonable rate.
I don't think that Tesla is making a car that can go long distances. They wouldn't be doing the Model S because the Model S specifically is a sports car, right?
Right, right.
So it's not like that's their goal. Their goal is to make and kind of overtake the petrol industry transportation system, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they're trying to do. And they're doing that in multiple ways. And one of them is to make an awesome, awesome car.
Mm-hmm.
The Tesla is an amazing vehicle, and that it can go that fast is insane and crazy. And
yeah. Although a 280-mile range
it's really
is
cool.
Not anything to sneeze at for
no,
an
no,
car.
No, that's really, really good. I wish I had one of those ranges. I could go to SF and party for the day and come back without charging. It'd be great.
Do you have time to party? Wow.
No. In my dream world where I have a Tesla and I'm good. Yeah, I do. When I do. I'm independently wealthy. Didn't you notice?
Oh, dear goodness. All right, guys. Conundrum of the week. At home, I've had a little time.
Mm.
Like 3 days in a row, we had bacon. And then I broke down and had a kale salad because you got to balance that stuff out.
Seriously? You toggle between bacon and kale?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That fits the story perfectly. Like you almost read it or something.
What?
Did you know that Oregon State University has recently patented a strain of succulent, marine succulent specifically, a red marine succulent algae,
mm-hmm.
which grows underwater, of course, and grows quickly. And they patented this so they can, I think, make money off of selling it because it has a wonderful little trait. And that is when you cook it and you taste it, it tastes like bacon.
And
it's as good and healthy as kale.
What?
Yes.
It's like the perfect food.
Yeah, it grows in the wild along the Pacific coast and Atlantic coastline, so it's like available a lot of places. And if you harvest it, and it'd be like $90 a pound dried. So that's actually really cheap when you think of how much bacon costs. Mm-hmm. Also, you're not killing a pig, and you don't have to feed the pig. Like, this algae just grows in the sea. So
does that make it kosher? That's the Canadian correspondent's question.
It's not shellfish, so I think so.
Maybe,
okay.
Maybe so.
Yeah. If that matters to you.
Kosher bacon.
Yeah, not mixing up your fish with your dairy, your meat with your dairy.
So are they patenting the seaweed itself? Because that seems a little weird to pluck something out of the sea and call it theirs. Or are they patenting the baconification?
No, the baconification is just about cooking it, really.
Okay.
It's also got a high protein. It's just kind of an amazing weed. So it sounds pretty exciting. I want to taste it bad.
Now, does it taste like bacon or is it just salty?
Claiming it tastes like bacon is a big claim. Also, is it the bacon that you dry and kind of crispy, or is it when it's not crispy and it's kind of the fatty, juicy part?
Raw bacon?
Where maybe it's like not done enough? That mixture is important. So
now, what about the fact they say that short pork tastes like long pork?
I don't understand what that means.
Long pork references humans. Disgusting.
Just like wondering, do we think it's tasty because it tastes like us?
So it says
like evolutionarily,
it has twice, supposedly, Toombs, one of the researchers, says that it's got Dulse is the name of this stuff, is a superfood with
Dulse
twice
flakes.
The nutritional value of kale. That's a quote. I don't know if that's really true, but
we've
cool.
made stuff with Dulse before.
Yeah, it's
so wouldn't we already know if it tastes like bacon?
Well, I think that this is a different strain. But
are they patenting their discovery of what they just thought of for the first time?
It's a genetically modified organism. Let's be clear about that.
Oh, it's evil.
No, I don't think it's genetically engineered. No.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think it was modified.
Or is it just like
unless I totally misunderstood
put together
the idea.
In a specific way.
No, it's just it's
when they say create a new strain.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh.
So, Lyle, you're hearing this from Oregon State University, and Miles, you've got a different source for this story. You heard about it from the New Zealand Herald?
Yes, who originally got their story from the Oregon State University, because the Oregon State University is where the actual thing was made.
All right. So if people are curious, they can look that up for themselves. Of course, we'll have links to those stories at our website, at geekspeak.org. That's how we do things here.
Sounds good.
On GeekSpeak, so you can find out for yourself. Let's move from something joyous to something utterly depressing. Depression. Can you talk about recent findings in what, like how depression might be caused?
Yeah, this is actually a study out of China, and I tried to get the researchers that were involved in this. It's there's a lot of people involved in this experiment. There was an experiment involving 5,000 Han Chinese women, and the article's in Nature magazine.
Okay.
And the study finds that depression, which of course, you know, in the U.S., about 7% of U.S. adults are have a clinically depressed episode. So it's a pretty common problem.
Right.
And that affects about 16 million people a year. And that's like experiencing a major depressive episode in that one year.
Right.
And this study, they took 5,000 Han Chinese women and did checked them on different depression metrics, and then did full genetic markup of them. Actually, only on I think chromosome 10, which is where they found these two markers. They found that there was a 1% correlation with these two different markers and depression. So a 1% slighter chance of depression if you had these markers versus if you didn't. Now I know
that
seems
kind of low.
It seems like a lot. It seems pretty low for what's going on. But keep in mind that
the human is statistically significant.
It is. That's the thing that's exciting about it. It's the first time we've actually found a genetic marker that directly correlates to depression.
Oh, I see.
And that's why it's useful. I mean, the medication we currently use for depression is based off of studies that are over 20 years old. Right. We're not on the cutting edge. Mm-hmm. And whenever you find a marker that a genetic marker that has a relation to a disease, you can then study what that marker is doing, what kind of proteins that's building, and you start getting really a lot closer to the disease problem. Like there might be, let's say there's a lot more genetic traits that are actually to this, but there's also a lot of expressions of proteins of the genome, the different proteins that get generated that could potentially affect healthy psychic ability, psychic qualities, right? So,
so
the idea of getting closer to it by having a marker, that means you can start really dissecting what that marker does, how it actually manifests into a protein, and then you're getting closer and closer to the reason for the disease.
And perhaps it's a big step. What to do to that marker to make it not be so depressing.
Right. For example, you could potentially, you could remove that by finding out what the protein is being generated and then balancing that with a drug very specifically. Mm-hmm. So now you're not doing this kind of, well, this drug seemed to work sometimes. Instead, you're really hitting
it's
and maybe
targeted.
Removing 1% of depression, right? I mean, that'd be amazing.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. Well, I hope that leads to another thing because in and of itself, it sounds promising. Hey, but
science
it doesn't
is
quite
always
do the
slow
trick.
Going.
It's one step at
it
a time
really
with
is.
Science. Speaking of science and, you know, keeping track of things so that you know what the heck's going on.
Yes, there is a new milestone that we've reached. It's awesome. We're number one, or at least last year was.
Who's we? And what?
The world.
Oh.
We've collectively done it. We've broken a record.
What record, Miles? What record?
It was the hottest year ever.
No.
Uh-oh.
That's not a good record
at all. That's the new weather. That's the global climate change.
Yes.
So...
Of which
did it change anyone's mind about whether or not it's real? Did that fact change anyone's mind about whether or not it's real?
Not so much. There's still folks gathering in various points to talk about how it's all a sham and it's going to send us over the brink economically and for no good reason.
You know, Miles, this is just depressing.
Hey.
Is it like marker 10 depressing or how depressing?
Well, on the bright side... the sun shining, which you should get more of, which can help with depression.
Yeah,
the sun
vitamin D,
and its output is not a significant factor to global climate change. It actually is anthropomorphic. So if you get out,
can you please describe what anthropomorphic is, please?
That's like Paddington Bear. Like they don't really wear gumshoes.
Human caused.
Thank you. What is it when you have an animal that you anthropomorphize? You make it into a human?
You ascribe human affectation or sensibilities to a non-human.
And that's called?
Anthropomorphizing.
And then if you have something that's caused by humans, it's called what?
Anthropogenic.
Anthropogenic.
Sorry about that.
Oh, okay.
So Miles made a verbal mistake.
Because I thought he was like putting sunglasses on the sun or something.
Awesome.
So cute.
That was your first. That's the first mistake, Miles.
Ever.
Yeah,
we've
been doing the show for 15 years, and you did it. You finally had a flub in your vocabulary.
that we caught.
That I caught, specifically this year.
So it's about who's vice president of the Pedantic Society now. So, All right.
Yeah, you should write it down. Just make sure you spell it correctly.
Yeah, there we go. You know, we have time for another depressing quickie.
This isn't actually depressing. This is amazing. This is an amazing feat of engineering.
Okay.
A person decided to make, by hand, a drone. You know what drones are, right?
The little
four-quad dropper. There's a lot of them out there, and you can buy these motors and stuff.
I saw them at fireworks. Did you see?
Oh, people make pictures of
fireworks? Displays. There, you can see a little drone light up there, like, I'm recording this fireworks.
I mean, the drones are great. I have a friend who teaches film at a high school and media in a high school, and they've got one now, and they're doing wonderful panning things with new. I mean, they're more and more. So the reason why this person decided to make them themselves is they needed a longer chassis and a really long separation from what you could buy off the shelf for, like, a game thing, because they wanted to mount something to it. So they made a longer chassis. They built a whole system up, but by parts they could buy relatively simply, all these motors and such. And they attached on top of this flying machine a handgun.
A
handgun, like a real handgun.
Like a gun?
Like a 9mm handgun.
Like a gun just flying around in the sky willy-nilly?
And then guess what they do? They fly it and shoot.
No.
And it's fine. It can fly around and shoot.
How can it fly around and shoot?
Because he's got remote control. Yeah, he's got a remote control, and he can fly his machine and shoot with it.
In other words, a civilian predator drone.
Yeah.
Is he still being allowed to roam the earth?
Well, there's nothing actually technically illegal about it. It was on his own property. But more than that, it's finally happened. We finally have flying death machines that people make. And this would not be hard to do for anybody to do this. It's really kind of scary.
Now, so what are we providing instructions at our website?
I wouldn't say we're doing that.
Let's not do that.
Yeah. On the bright side, artificial intelligence is not to the point where Skynet is an issue.
Okay.
On the bright side, we're not good at computer science. So
but what about Boston Dynamics?
On the bad side, chances are when AI is good enough, it's going to be someone who's just kind of gung-ho and not taking care of their bug tracking and not running unit tests. That's going to
not doing the robot.
Yeah, it's going to bring the end of humanity.
Yeah,
I for one welcome our non-unit tested robot overlords.
Oy.
This one was obviously manually powered, and the thing that was scary. I've flown these things, and rotating them in space, like having them turn left and right, is very easy. You just push a button, and if I had something firing a handgun, I'd be really scared about pushing that side button where it started panning.
You know what we will have on our website is the video.
There's a full video.
Right? He took a video of this
thing. Yeah, the video on YouTube. In fact, there's not a lot of data about it except for what the video is, 30 seconds, three shots, or four seconds.
Okay. Yeah. You know, if I were the person who made this, I wouldn't provide a lot of data either.
No.
About how to find me, for instance.
But you can find us pretty easily.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, you can find us on geekspeak.org or at KOSPGeeks. Come at us, man.
Facebook and Twitter only, please.
Virtual engagement only, please. Man. All right, you are listening to Geekspeak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean with Miles and Lyle, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to Geekspeak on KOSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Miles Elam and Lyle Troxell. And my gosh, there's a lot to talk about today. Like, already sort of fascinating, the whole website, Ashley Madison.
What's Ashley Madison? Who is Ashley Madison?
It's a dating website specifically for those who want a little on the side or something.
Yep.
Yeah, a little controversial.
I thought that was called Tinder and Craigslist.
Well, Tinder is supposed to be you just want to get
POF
But is this it's a particular setup or something?
Right. It's supposed to be set up so that you can't get caught easily.
Right.
It's supposed to be private information.
First off, is Ashley Madison a celebrity that I should know?
No, I don't think it's a person.
It's the name of the site.
It's the name of a site.
It may be two snootily named ladies. I don't know.
Okay.
But something happened to it recently.
Wait. So Ashley Madison, you go up there and people cheat on each other and they don't get caught.
Right.
It's where you go up there
to find someone to cheat with.
Can I predict what happened? I haven't read the story.
Someone got found out.
The idea is if you go to the site, you are not going to find someone who is upset that you are married, because that other person is probably married as well and trying to find someone who is also married so that they can goof around.
And it's specifically not designed for married people to cheat on each other?
No, it absolutely is.
Yeah, it's designed for if you're going to cheat, to find a way to do it securely and safely.
Okay,
I love the fact that there's going to be half the audience is going like, oh, that is really sleazy, that's horrible. And there's another half going, really, what's this site?
AshleyMadison.com.
And that's A-S-H-L-E-Y.
Not that I have a pessimistic view of the world out there, but
all right. So what happened to the Ashley Madison site?
They got hacked.
Uh-oh. So when getting hacked means that people's private information is often revealed, is that what happened?
What they're doing is Ashley Madison also has another practice, which is they will charge you
$20 a week to keep it secret?
No. If you want your profile deleted, they will charge you, I don't know if it's $19 or £19. I have to.
We can delete your account or we can send it to your spouse.
Yeah, for $19, they will delete your account.
So this is a little riff on the whole, we've got your information held hostage, and if you want it, then pay and we'll unlock your computer.
So this group hacked them and got their information. I mean, really got everything.
All the user information.
Information, but also got corporate information, like how much people were paid, payroll, stuff like that.
Are they morally motivated, or are they just see an easy buck?
Well, there's a question.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But the thing is that their ransom here is, hey, Ashley Madison, either you shut down or we spread this information out and like start emailing all the people that are on there.
Okay.
So that sounds politically motivated to me.
It sounds more morally motivated. And so is there a price that Ashley Madison has to pay? Because then the question becomes foggy.
The price is they're being told to shut down.
Shut down. Okay.
Yeah.
So they're being blackmailed to shut down, or they will tell all their customers, partners, that the partners have been cheating. I mean, basically, both ways, Ashley Madison is over, right?
Yes.
Because either all the customers are going to have horrible experiences.
Just Ashley Madison, but related sites, Cougar Life and Established Men. Both of them tailored toward people who are older and more established.
Yeah.
And you're trying to attract, you know, younger...
Young things.
Yeah.
I like that it's
young
Established
trophies.
Man and Cougar something.
Yeah, establishment,
like
not life. Established
how
lady.
How sexism just the names. It's wonderful.
Yeah. I know.
Ugh.
Huh.
Well, so they're going to be shut down. Effectively, they are shut down. And hopefully
we'll see how things go.
The thing is, they might shut them down and then release all the data.
They have the belief that they know who did it, and it was an inside job per se. It wasn't an employee, but it was someone who had access to their network.
Okay.
Wait.
To all three networks.
How can you have a non-employee access to your network?
Because they're consultants and people who choose.
And someone said, wait a second, this doesn't seem very good to me.
Are we seeing a rise potentially in the increase of employees and the decrease of contractors as a result of breaches like this?
Who knows? I mean,
I wonder how many customers they have.
It estimates they have somewhere around 37 million users.
What?
37 million?
Well, hold on.
We know about dating sites because there's the people who actually use it, and then there's all the looky-loos.
Oh, yeah. These aren't paid, right? You only pay if you want to get your data off?
I believe that's the case,
So you get a free account until they – yeah, that makes sense. They assure they have 37 million people.
We'll find out.
Yeah, right. Well, wait a second. I love this idea that they promise this idea that you wouldn't get caught, and then they're just nailed. Right. You know, if you're online, it's public. That's how it works.
Governments have been hacked. Government security systems hacking have been hacked.
So let's take I don't know, 10% of those people maybe are active, right? So 300,000 people. That's a lot.
That's
people.
Still a lot of people. And at 1999 a pop or whatever.
Well, let's say, but now it's not to 1999. I mean, the hackers might actually release this data, right?
Yeah.
So we're talking, if you're a lawyer right now, you really want to start practicing divorce law because there's going to be a major boon.
Yeah, there's some conspiracy theories out there saying that some law firm was the one who actually did the hack.
In that case, I do want to just make a pitch for family law mediation.
Oh, yes. That's a good idea. Mediation.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can really make money on that, Bonnie.
No, well, you can't. Well, some mediators got to be able to make money.
That's true.
Just because the slogan is good enough that I want to read it for Ashley Madison.
Okay.
Life is short. Have an affair.
Wow.
Like, there's no pretense about this.
I wonder why they were targeted by hackers or decent people. Wow.
Gee. All right. Well, I mean, there's an interesting trend here on I think you're wrong, therefore I'm hacking you.
Yes, there is a bit of that.
Right?
Yes,
I mean,
definitely.
Anonymous started that, I guess we could say.
Be honest, that's been the motivation to a lot of places that have tried to hack Amazon or tried to hack Google or tried to – it's they say, like, I have a problem with whatever X they're doing, whether it be, you know, someone has a dating site for people who want to cheat, or you have privacy standards that I don't agree with, or
– Right.
So – So you've all heard of the can we go on to the next story?
Yeah, sorry. That's fine. But there's like a kernel there that I want to pick up later about, you know, like what's going to happen with all the sort of moral hacking when people with the moral high ground do a low ground thing like hack.
Well, that's the thing. Well, moral high ground is a very subjective thing.
It sure is.
Well, I mean, okay, so we could definitely say that we think it. I mean, most people think that cheating on your spouse is a morally incorrect thing to do. Is that the right way to say morally wrong?
Sure. And, you know, people have different definitions of cheating.
Right.
But yeah, if you're doing something
generally
behind your spouse's back, that's unpartnerly at the very least.
Yes. Generally, people shun this. So therefore, if you were to act upon it, stopping that, seems like it's a moral thing to do, right?
Yeah.
At any cost, though?
But that's the thing. Then you break laws. Yeah, that's the question. But I don't know. We tend to like in our society this idea of a Robin Hood figure, right? The person that steals and breaks the rules, and because the laws are unjust.
Well, it's in this situation, just in
America. It depends. We like Robin Hood as long as we're not the ones who have the gold.
Right. Well, and who's the name of the drug lord who escaped from maximum security prison in
Chapo?
Mexico? Yeah, he's seen as a Robin Hood figure in his country.
In some areas. So so do you think of these hackers as Robin Hood-y? I mean, they're not asking for money. They're asking to shut a service down. They're clearly helping people be immoral.
I have a problem with a vigilante justice in general online.
Well, so there's nothing illegal about that site, obviously.
Right.
So therefore, you can't do anything legally about it. It's going to exist.
Right.
So the only way to do something is to get ugly?
Well, that's the question. Is if you
that's assuming you have the moral right to do so, like that you have the moral standing.
You don't like vigilantism.
What I'm saying is, you don't like vigilantism. The idea of that, you want to work within the system. But if a system is totally accepting,
no, I don't mean
legality.
Just working within the system. I mean, if you're using a principle of universality, in other words, if I do this particular case, would all the other cases that it might apply be acceptable as well?
Yeah.
And it's that same thing that goes along with free speech. It's like if I'm not willing to protect the person that I really don't like what they're saying, then what happens when someone else doesn't like what I'm saying or someone tries to silence someone that I do agree with? Mm-hmm. You have to – there has to be some line that you draw, some common theme throughout that you can have some consistency.
And that's your moral compass.
Yeah, well, otherwise it
it's
ends up being the might makes right. Whoever's got the better hackers is going to be the one in charge.
Uh-huh. Well, all right. So it's problematic. We'll pick it up again later.
Okay.
It is sort of behind all of the hacks that we're seeing, all the anonymous hacks. Like, we don't think you're right, and we're going to get you, right?
Yes.
It's not okay in one sense. It's problematic. I could do with a little bauble right now,
a
juicy little something.
Well,
maybe like a unique take on a well-known subject.
Okay, so we all know the Supreme Court recently ruled that same-sex marriage is completely legal and not against the Constitution anyway. Yes,
yeah.
That's the Obergefell versus Hodges. Is that how you pronounce it?
Obergefell
versus Hodges case. The thing that was interesting about that from a geek perspective, and I think actually this hit me. Not necessarily in this time of the debate, but long ago when we first started seeing, I think 2008 when we started seeing same-sex marriages, one of the things that emerged in my mind was a complete geek perspective of database structures and relational database structures.
Really? In your mind?
Yes.
Wow.
Because I've done a lot of database
development. You're a database guy. Yeah. You've done
database
stuff.
Development. And it's very common in a database to create assumptions in the system and then codify that assumptions. So there's this wonderful article by Sam Hughes, a few of them actually, about... basically, he wrote one, I think, in 2008 and then is upgraded over the time about the problem of codifying a marriage in a data structure. So let's say you have a people table, and in the people table you might have a husband ID and a wife ID, and only one of those could be valid, and it had to be opposite of the gender you are, and it has to be different than who you are, like the data structure of what marriage is.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start modifying the assumptions, all of a sudden you don't have a husband ID and a wife ID. That's not necessarily
true. You just
have
like a person and a person.
Right. You might have a marriage ID, right, that would reference the next person. And then you'd have to have some kind of value of what they then declare themselves to be, a husband or wife or wife or wife or husband. You know, like that, the structure of that could be in any direction.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be gender-based. And so basically this wonderful article talking about the problems of modifying the data structure and how you would deal with that. And the long and the short of it is, you cannot assume that your data structure when you're dealing with a database is correct. What you have to assume is that your data structure will change over time.
Oh, so
and
it has to be flexible.
And you have to be really good at modifying it. So the SQL language, which is this whole article, uses the SQL Lite, simple query language SQL.
Structured query language.
Structured? Yeah. Oh, I thought it was simple.
It varies.
Okay. Structured or simple query language. Thank you, Mr. Pedantic. And no, I mean, that's a very clearly different term.
Yes,
it uses that language. In that language, you can modify a table. You can, you know, create the joins differently. You can do everything you want to do with live data in the system. So okay. You can modify it on the fly. Mm-hmm. But if you only have to do that every once in a while, it's going to be brittle and difficult. If you get very comfortable as a database administrator and an application developer to change these things on the fly mm-hmm. and know that, yep, I can change this stuff and I can test afterwards. So it's all about being flexible in your computer system and making change. And in years of computer science.
Isn't that a metaphor for life?
Yeah. Well, it's really wonderful. It
wow.
really is. In fact, it's one of the core principles of what I think about technology. When people say, you know, you seem to know about technology and everything. Why? And the reason is that I don't accept anything will be this way forever. Mm-hmm. And anytime it changes, I accept the change as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So when Apple, for example, changed the way they scrolled the window, some people inverted it so it used to be it was the way it used to be. I don't do that. I make myself go through the change because what you need to do in technology is be flexible. And so anyway,
that's true if you're making it or trying to wield it.
Yeah, no, it's doubly so when you're trying to wield it.
I know. Yeah. I just like, oh, okay, good. iTunes has changed on me again. That's good job security for all the UI folks over at iTunes. But boy, how annoying for me.
So this table structure was actually that he had a people table and then he had a marriages. And in the marriages, there was husband ID and wife ID and mm-hmm. marriage date and divorce date.
Okay.
And in the data structure, he talks about the problems of, well, you got to get rid of the husband ID and the wife ID. You've got to get, you know, person one ID and person two ID. And then you got to make sure that the same person can't marry themselves. And maybe it doesn't make sense to have two marriages in the same table with the same people. But then again, what happens if you get married and then you get divorced and the same people get married again?
Which happens.
Which would be valid. So yeah. There's a lot of complexity around relatively simple concept when you're trying to codify it in code.
Yeah.
In any case, just the idea that you have to be extremely flexible, I thought was a really fun topic. And this is a great way to think about that data structure schema. So
boy,
I'll have
tell
that
you
up.
What?
At geekspeak.org, definitely.
This show just got deep. It's important to be flexible and ready for change because guess what, folks? It's the only constant.
It really is.
let's see. We will be back after a break. This is Geek Speak here on KUSP. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean, and I'm here with Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. And Miles, you have an update on our ongoing investigation into the deployment of fiber.
Mm. Yes, ever since
this is not another kale story. Let's just be clear about that.
That was a bacon story.
It was a bacon story.
Yeah, that wasn't kale.
It was a seaweed story, if you want to be specific.
It was more a bacon story in my heart.
Okay, in your heart, it was bacon.
We're talking about fiber in terms of optical. Fiber optics.
Yeah. Okay, so this is about
transfer communication.
Yeah, okay.
And one of the side effects to Title II being passed by the FCC, making internet providers common carriers.
The common carrier thing, yes.
It allows for competition from municipalities, especially ones that have not been served by the incumbents.
Mm-hmm.
That if you have a cable company or a telecom company decide that they just don't predict that there's going to be enough demand in a particular area or it's not densely populated enough to make it worth their while, they won't serve it. You're left out. You don't mm-hmm. have the access.
Mm-hmm.
And so many places, like for example, Lavalle, I don't know for Wisconsin, how you would pronounce that. They have a town of 1,300 residents, and that's not something that's going to get a telecom going, whoa, 1,300 people.
Right.
I want to get to that market. So what they were doing was they're getting a loan from the Department of Agriculture. That's where the loans and grants are coming from.
The Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, well. And they're going to be setting up a fiber network.
Huh.
And so they're going to get gigabit Ethernet and IP addresses to their available to their 1,300 residents.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So is it, I'm guessing, an agrarian
It's mostly for rural communities.
Okay.
Like I said, the places where they kind of got forgot by the big boys.
You know what's hilarious is I live in the woods, not far from Silicon Valley.
Above Silicon Valley, looking out.
Yeah, literally looking down onto Silicon Valley. I feel so superior. And there are several big tech executives that live in that place, and it has terrible internet connection. Terrible. So I wonder if the Department of Agriculture wants to help the poor executives of Silicon Valley who cannot get good internet access where they live.
Yeah, I'd love good internet access where my father-in-law lives in Sonora. Things in,
right?
In Sonora itself is actually not so bad, but it's a rural community. It's very spread out. So once you get past a certain point, things get slow fast.
Rural fast.
So you have your choice of DSL that's basically on the edge of the distance that's allowable, which means that you get, I don't know, anywhere between 1.5 megabit to half a megabit or less.
So, and
then there's satellite, which just costs an arm and a leg if you try to do anything like Netflix on it.
So it's true then that any group could get together and just invest and make something happen. As we saw in the town in Wisconsin, sometimes there's not enough money among the actual individuals, but you can get a grant here and there.
Well, it was a loan, actually.
It was a loan. Yeah.
Well, actually, let me double check that.
Was it a loan or a grant?
That ends up being important, isn't it? No, it's a loan.
Ars Technica.
It's a $7.61 million loan.
Okay. Wow. So they have to pay it back.
Yes.
So that's problematic.
Not really. You have a subscriber base there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing Santa Cruz is doing with their fiber project with Cruzeo.
Oh, is that how Cruzeo is doing
City? When we talked with Chris Nicholson, that was exactly what's going on, is that you basically take out a loan and a bond, basically the city, you build that system up, and then over the next 15 years, you pay it off by subscriber fees. And at the end of the period, the city owns it, which is pretty fantastic. Oh. Or in this case situation, the actual consumer base owns it, if you will, the members of the fiber network.
Is that going to be
different.
Just like the Road Association from Hell, though?
That sounds like
up the ISP.
Totally sounds like. Though an ISP, it's not as complicated as a road in the sense that it's not like you have to patch holes or anything like that, you know.
But it does have to be kept up, no?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, of course. It does have to be kept up, but it's not like the wear and tear on a street.
Okay.
I mean, I've been a Road Association member, so definitely.
Yeah, you know all about that part.
Sorry, I definitely know how painful that is.
Okay. Huh. Well, that's exciting.
But on a related note.
Yeah.
There is a story from a while back, which is that vandals are snipping fiber optic cables in California.
Why?
Right and left.
For the copper?
No, there's no copper.
No, there's no copper.
Well, actually, it's undersea ones have a lot of copper in them, but not the street variety.
No, it's vandalism.
Just straight up, huh?
Well, the thing is, fiber lines are really well marked. All over the place. Because,
cut here.
Yeah, well, they basically are, you know, here, be careful, don't dig. Or here, be careful, dig this up and cut it. I mean,
yeah.
But it's also hard to find where that splice may be.
Yeah.
To find where that cut was done.
It's such a specific form of vandalism. I wonder if it's also morally driven.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, there's no limit to anti-tech sentiment.
You're just walking down in the street with some wire clippers going, what can I cut?
So you guys all know about the New Horizons flyby, right, of Pluto?
Yeah,
yeah,
it's a big deal. We got
covered
some
last
pictures.
Week, yeah,
right?
We got some beautiful pictures.
Nice pics.
And we're going to get pictures. This is the great thing about this is that the data, the baud rate, the amount of data that can be transferred by this thing is comparable to a 96K modem, which is old before DSL speeds, real slow.
Yeah.
And so these really high resolution, the cameras are really good, right?
It must have taken a long time to transmit.
No, it's going to take years. Like it's going to take 2 years to get the data.
2 years? Really?
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was about a year and a half.
Wait,
anyway,
how do we get stuff now?
2 years and a year and a half is not similar. Thank you, Mr. Pedantic. So if you want to know a little bit more about this, there's a great discussion by Stephen Colbert and Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, I bet
we're going to have it up on GeekSpeak. And it's basically just a dialogue from them. Stephen Colbert making fun of Neil deGrasse Tyson, who actually led the committee to some degree to classify Pluto and other things like that.
Pluto.
Well, to make it a dwarf planet rather than a full planet. And
demoted
the discussion's
it.
A lot of fun.
Demoted
it's not a demotion. It's a reclassification.
It's a demotion. Poor little Pluto.
Anyway, they have his picture. They have a talk about it. Very informal and a lot of fun. And they'll be up at geekspeak.org.
Well, I just want to say that as a host of GeekSpeak, I hereby decree that anything even remotely geek-related involving Stephen Colbert, I think, should be a mandatory reporting for the show.
Yes, ma'am. So we got that,
that man
Stephen Colbert.
Well. Mm-hmm.
And you also like
Tyson.
Oh, you like him too. Okay,
yeah.
Good. And then Tesla guy. Wasn't it?
Elon Musk. That's you guys.
Oh, really?
You guys are the fanboys.
Oh, I'm
think
not
he's,
a fan. No,
he's lovely and all. No, I tease you guys. I'm like, oh, look what he did in SpaceX. Yeah. Oh. Is he building the Hyperloop? Oh, my gosh.
I thought that was you. We've all been teasing each other about Elon Musk. That's wonderful.
Who is the fan? Is no one a fan? Wait a minute. Okay. So we'll catch up with that at geekspeak.org. Now, my honey made fun of me when I had a Windows phone.
Oh, yeah. And rightly so.
And okay.
No, I'm just kidding. That's always a bad thing.
I mean,
to
it was, I think, the first version. So and I was an early adopter.
Is that why you have an iPhone now?
I have an iPhone because I have been accepted into the family Borg. But also of great interest to me is that Siri is not going to be the only lady helping people set their timers on their phones and so on.
Walk in. So yeah, Siri, as everyone knows, is Apple's artificial intelligence, the best assistant, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It is, you can ask Siri to make an appointment for yourself, an alarm or whatever, and it will kind of understand what you're talking about and most of the time frustrate you. Mm-hmm. But in general, it's fun to play with.
Yeah.
Well, everyone's playing this game, and Google has some search commands that are voice command as well on Android devices.
Mm-hmm.
And that interface is – they don't really have a name for all of it, but one of the things that it does is Google Now is actually one of the feature set that's similar to – it's an artificial assistant – artificial intelligence assistant, Google
that's
Now.
What the, okay, Google. That's what that's
yeah,
about,
you can
right?
do a voice search. Mm-hmm. But more what Google does is kind of reads your inbox of email and kind of looks at your searches for your calendar entries and also looks at what searches on maps you've done and then kind of coalesces that feed into a time-based card system for you. The general idea is if you got in your email, you got a ticket from Air American Airlines because you're flying somewhere and your email got that, then Google's going to scan that, see that it's a flight, and then add that to your calendar in the Google Now interface. And all of a sudden, your card is there in the morning you're getting to the trip to the airport, and you have your boarding information right at your fingertips. Very convenient. I think it's neat. I mean, yeah, you might think it's creepy, but I think
no,
it's
neat. No, it is convenient, and then...
It launched when they launched Google Glass.
Yeah.
That's why I was using Google Glass all the time, because of Google Now. It's kind of a cool feature that kind of parses your information. It's like an assistant.
Okay.
Any case, Microsoft is also doing a project that's similar to both those things. They announced a while ago, and it's Cortana.
Right. Yeah.
Like Katana, but... Cortana. And Cortana is basically an AI character. In fact, it came, which is really cool, it came from the Microsoft's Halo video game. It's a really popular video game.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the artificial intelligence character, and it's voiced by Jen Taylor,
same lady, actress, right?
Who's voicing this system and also the game system.
So,
thanks to our assistant Chandler who told us that.
Yeah, thank you, Chandler.
So this is basically a voice control system that works on the Microsoft phone. Actually, OS 10 is what it's working on. I'm sorry, Microsoft 10 is a part of the operating system.
Right.
They also just recently kind of accidentally released the Android version of this as well. And so you can download and run this on an Android device, which actually has enough power to run it. and it seems pretty cool. It's not going to have the – and they've also announced in May, Microsoft announced that they would release this for iOS as well, for Apple.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they're trying to move in on Siri's territory.
All the big boys are fighting, right?
Excuse me, Cortana. I believe you're in my spot.
Yeah, and I think Cortana is a better name than Siri, I've got to say.
It sounds like a real name.
The problem, of course, is integrating these kind of feature sets, these kind of integrated, like highly engaged feature sets into other operating systems, is they're not going to get the same quality of richness that they get on their primary device. For example, if you use Google Now on your iOS device, which you can do, you can't actually get it triggered via voice command. On an Android phone, you can say, "Hey Google," and it will talk to you, right?
Right.
On an Android, on a iOS phone, the only phone feature that can do that is Siri, and so Cortana will be the same thing. You won't be able to say, "Excuse me, Cortana, please do this." Instead, you have to launch the app, and then it can do things.
Yeah.
You also won't be able to do auto replies and things of that nature. Kind of more integrated things. In any case, I think it's kind of exciting. I wish I was back on an Android phone right now to play with this because I love this kind of. An assistant that's kind of trying to figure out what you need.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of like the paperclip.
Uh-huh.
The idea behind it is always fascinating.
I see you're writing a text.
The execution is almost always horrible. But, you know, we've seen successes in Siri. We've definitely seen successes in Google Now.
Uh-huh.
And Microsoft's going to kind of step into the fray at a pretty serious level. Because if it's better than – and this is a big if it's better than what Google's doing with Google Now and search commands and actually functions on an Android phone, there's nothing saying you couldn't jump into an Android environment and use this as your primary digital assistant, if you will.
But also when there's more than one game in town, then maybe the healthy competition improves
technology overall. Yeah, that's the hope, right? That's definitely the hope.
Yeah, that's straight up Econ 101. I don't know if it's relevant still in the real world. But there we go. We'll tune in and see how Cortana does in the long run with all the other folks in there.
We have any more stories?
No.
Oh, no. Well, Miles is
Oh, wait. We do have one more.
Yes.
I got confused because it's below a non-story note of my own, which I'm now getting
teasing
rid of.
Miles.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I get for teasing Miles in script form. All right. So this is something to help flying.
This is folks in the so pilots for the British Airline Pilots Association, BALPA.
BALPA. That's a fun thing to say.
Because we love acronyms here.
Yeah.
Have stated that they don't want lithium batteries, like the kind we find in our cell phones and tablets and other electronic devices, in the cargo hold.
Why?
They want them in the cabin. They want them as carry-on luggage.
Wait, what? Anything with a lithium battery?
Lithium-based batteries, yes.
Why does that? Why about that?
Because when they catch fire,
Boy, do they catch fire.
The thing is, well, yes, that they will do a very hot fire.
Okay.
Although it is very localized, but if you don't know that that fire has started, and that fire catches on to things that are in the cargo hold in general, like other pieces of luggage, you could end up with a serious fire that could take the airplane down.
They prefer to have those fires in the cabin with the people.
Well, there you'd be able to recognize it immediately. You'd be able to do something about it. You could.
I don't understand. Are they
scream
just
and
like
run?
No, you don't need to scream and run.
Or do lithium batteries just spontaneously combust all the time?
They don't spontaneously combust all the time. The issue is
just
that
part of the time.
There is no technology that is completely foolproof, and lithium-based batteries as a class have a very high energy density relative to other technologies. And that energy density that allows you to have a cell phone that lasts all day long, unless you have phones that don't have a big enough battery, or the laptops that are billed as the all-day battery, things like that, that is an enormous amount of energy.
Okay.
Relative to
risky.
The space.
Yeah. But it kind of seems like something must have happened because it's an awfully specific thought.
There have been fires. And some of it is also the precautionary principle. There have been incidents with regard to airlines. There was a new type of aircraft. I forgot the model number, that used batteries as a way to make things more efficient when it was on the ground and up in air. It's kind of a hybrid.
Yeah.
And it caught fire because the heat, the environment it was in wasn't sufficiently, it wasn't kept sufficiently cool. And once it got into a sufficient heat level, you had a runaway condition where it just got worse and worse and worse and worse until you had combustion.
Ew. Okay. So in the cabin, you'd be able to catch that much sooner and maybe there'd be a fire extinguisher there that you could wield.
There is the amount of smoke that comes off of it, and that is an issue. In a closed compartment area that, you know, where everyone has their air recycled.
Right.
But you could have some mitigating factors for it, like the fact that not everything is catching on fire, like you don't have a major cargo hold fire, is still a plus.
It's contained within the bin.
Right. And there is something to be said for the drink tray or the snack
tray. That tray that goes into an upright locked position?
No. I'm talking about the thing that the stewards and stewardesses will bring.
Oh, the cart.
Cart, thank you.
Yeah.
To be able to throw it in there.
Yeah, I mean, basically the idea is that you don't want a fire to spread. And if it's where people are, it's more likely that it won't spread, or at least people will be aware of it as it spreads. It's relatively easy to put it out unless it's completely trapped inside a giant pile of burnable things that can continue.
Actually, lithium batteries are not very easy to put out.
No, meaning that it won't continue to spread.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
Yes.
There's steel. There's steel.
That's the whole thing is you don't want it to spread.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Unfortunately, they are not easy to put out.
No,
they're very hard to put out.
But they're also less and less likely to happen.
Yes, the quality control on them.
I have to say, it is kind of amazing that we are allowing lithium-ion batteries to be in cases and stuff when we are very careful about screening bombs and things.
Right, and not nail clippers.
Technically,
can you store it next to your knitting needles or what?
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the reasons why they don't want to have luggage on the plane if you are the person that had the luggage and you leave the plane. Like that luggage has to get out of there too because it's relatively easy to make something that's dangerous.
Okay. Well, so I guess if you have a lithium battery in a device, keep it with you and
that's
also
why the
a
rule,
fire extinguisher.
The rule will be you'll have to keep it with you on carry stuff. Yeah. But, you know, most people do because you want your laptop not to be thrown around in luggage.
Right. So if you wanted to actually set off some pandemonium with your lithium battery, I could just hide it deep within the bin so it has the best chance of really getting a good fire going before it gets
Well, this is a request by the Pilots Association. This is not actual policy.
Cool. The Pilots Association was like, well, if you're going to be taking people's safety pins away from them, you should probably get the giant explosive things out of the cargo hold, please.
So then now it's an even more interesting story because did something happen to a pilot?
No, it's just that they're intelligent people and they're thinking the danger we have is this. Well, let's make a recommendation.
Yeah, it's the precautionary principle.
I love it.
It baffles me still to this moment. But I'm just going to have to live with that kind of doubt. Yeah.
One last thing. Wonderful company is making an electric scooter with a bin. And it's only $3,000, and you can use it for, you know, travel relatively long distance, not crazy long distances. It's called the Gen Z 2 electric scooter, and it's got like a little – it's like the pickup truck of scooters. Anyway,
like a little bin that you could put your groceries in, put your lithium battery.
No, you could put your lithium battery.
But
as long as you don't close the lid.
Yeah, then you might catch fire.
30 miles an hour, 30 to 40 miles an hour, 30 to 35 miles in a single journey, a single charge.
That's
not long
cool.
distance, but kind of cool for, you know, city travel.
You know, I was at IKEA the other day, and they very politely had one little thing of bicycle parking. And I thought, who goes to IKEA with their bicycle? But I guess if you had a scooter with a bin.
Yeah, there you go.
Could park it there. All right. Well, that's enough geek speak for the week, don't you think? That's what this show has been. If you'd like to communicate with the show, one way you can reach geek speak is via Twitter or Facebook. We're KUSP Geeks. That's all one word. If you have any questions or comments for us, do send them along. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And that's us for the week. Thanks for listening.
Great. That was 53 minutes and 16 seconds.
Okay.
Minus so 2 minutes is 51.
Too many seconds.
Yeah, but we have some break in the middle, the music in the beginning, and we got some cut.
And we had some padding before the first break.
Oh, all right. So
that is hilarious, by the way.
Yeah.
So here's some extra bonus. Let's do a little extra bonus features. Today's show, if you could detect it after I edit it, we had this really wonderful audio timing system, like this timer that Miles made out of
it
one SVG file. It was beautiful.
Gorgeous. I praised its beauty.
And what happens in the show is we do timers so that we can record the show and then cut it later without staying up too late to make it perfectly fit in the 51 minutes.
Cares about.
I think people care. Geeks care. Do you want to hear the details of Geeks? You know, Geek Speak, you keep listening. If not, get the heck out of here. And you guys, what happened about 17 minutes into the show, which is about when we need to take our first break, is the screen
just went blank.
Just went white.
Well, it went that way about 2 or 3 minutes into the show, and I tried to recover from it.
So the beginning, that's right. It's right away.
Story.
That's right. It's the beginning of the show because Miles had the first two stories, and that's why I covered one of them I hadn't read. I did it on the fly.
You did a good job.
Thank you. Thank you. But
job.
It felt a little like, oh, my God. And Miles hacked. By the time I finished that first story and he took over, he had already rewritten he'd changed the timing of the app, restarted it.
Fixed it.
And then it went white
then
again.
Then it busted again.
But that never happened in development. It must be something I've got in my machine. It must be like
There is a difference between them. The development machine that I'm working on is a 3-year-old laptop with a standard res screen. Yours is a high res screen, which means it may have more pixels that it has to deal with, which explains some of the chunkiness, which I don't quite understand because your machine is more modern.
It
should be able to handle that.
It wasn't an animation on Miles' machine. That's what Miles is talking about.
But I have never seen a disco, like literally the screen just went blank.
Like,
everything on it, all the text, everything gone.
So when all is said and done, do you think we could actually have a link to it or something up on geekspeak.org so
you know,
people
what
can
we'll
know
do is
what you're talking about?
We'll just link to the zip file. People can see it. Do you want to open source it? We'll actually relatively soon add it to the geekspeak.org website's code base, which is at on GitHub.
Yeah.
And so the source code for that will be available as well.
Yep.
Why not? But we'll have to figure out why the bug is occurring first.
Yeah.
I have not seen this kind of thing on a web app. Though I have to say, my assumption right now is there's a bug in my version of some plugin or something that I've got going. I do have a thing called Vim plugin. Do you know about the Vim plugin on Chrome?
Yeah. It's taking a 40-year-old, largely obsolete text editor.
50-year-old editor.
And trying to hoodwink it into the modern era. Yeah.
Basically, Vim is a – what does Vim stand for? VI
improved. Visual, yeah.
Visual interface?
No.
I don't know what VIM stands for. Wow. First acronym you and I have both failed at. In any case, it's an editor, and the editor actually, the way you navigate, this is before mice, right? So you had two modes. You had navigation modes. Bonnie, come on. This is highly geeky stuff. People love this kind of thing. And in any case, I'm going to cut your mic. So in any case, VIM allows you to move around the text editor. Are you saying the show's over? Okay, email Bonnie. She's geeks at geekspeak.org.
Tell me what it stands for.
No, we're done. The plugin allows you to navigate your browser like you would a text document using VI. So if you know VI really well, you can navigate your browser. But it injects JavaScript and parses the file, and I'm assuming that that's why Miles' thing didn't work.
Okay.
Or it could be that he sucks at coding.
Yeah. let the record show there are no display nuns in this code base. There are no visibility.
It's a mystery. If only we had some web developers that knew anything about coding.
I blame his hardware. I totally blame.
You know, the funny thing is, Ben had one running, and we've been using it for a long time, and it never failed. It was perfect.
As long as you started at exactly 6 minutes after the hour.
Or 36 minutes after the hour. All right, I'm going to unmute the Canadian correspondent and Chandler, and let's wrap this one up.
Okay.
That's the extras.
Yeah, that's how we do it. Thanks, everybody.
Hey, Chandler. Hey, Greg.
Hey, hey. Bonnie, do you want to redo the podcast intro?
If you want to, it's time to do it now.
So, okay, I will do it.
Okay, wait. Go ahead and quiet, and Bonnie, go.
Hey, podcast listeners. You're listening to a recording made on the 20th of July, 2015.